running things, and I think that probably continued through at Intel.
How would you describe his main contributions across the board at Fairchild with respect to the R&D organization, with his own technical contributions?
Well, in the early days, he was technically involved with the diffusion. As I said, Dave Allison was in. Gordon certainly took on the role of evaporation and metallization stuff. That was his own thing, and that was a problem that really bothered us, how we could make electrical contact with both an N and P type silicon. Again, you could prove that you couldn't do any of these things. and Gordon gives a lot of credit to a conversation he had with Noyce, and I said, why don't you try aluminum, which worked. But the standard gold ideas did not. So Gordon made a lot of contributions there. He was very well organized and sort of took on the pre-production coordination of engineering. So he took the devices and got them to the point where we could make them and get ready for production. Mm-hmm. He did all that stuff in a very organized way. I have always had an enormous respect for him and that, the way he worked and conducted himself in that environment, you know, doing what had to be done and trying to deal with the number of prima donnas that could be difficult and avoiding the conflict that Jean Hernie steadily wanted to set up. John was something else. I mean, I could go on by the hour about him, but on Gordon's case, I had a holding in very high respect. And I remember an incident a number of years later when they put a plaque on the state historical put a plaque on the building. And Gordon was there, and he gave an appropriate talk, and I went up to him afterwards and said, you know, Gordon, you're standing up there giving all this credit to Noyce, but I know damn well, and you know, the enormous contributions that you made that are going unrecorded here. I said that to him.
And what did he?
Didn't say much one way or the other. But you know how I felt about it, and I do.
Why do you think he did that or does that?
I think he's looking at the goal rather than his personal acknowledgement of his contribution to it. Yeah, I think if he can avoid confrontation, he'll do it. But as I said, he was the one that had the guts to call Beckman.
Right.
And he was the only one that did, and he saw the goal there. I've always had a great admiration for him and the way he conducted himself, and still do. And I'm glad now, as time has settled and Noyce's image has receded, that Gordon is getting his fair due for his enormous contributions. Our relations are very cordial. I'm always glad to see him, and you're probably going to get fried by the sun there.
I'll scoot you over a little bit. Thanks. It was feeling a little warm.
Yeah, problem I haven't solved here.
Well, perhaps we could return to, the discussions with Singleton and Teledyne.
Yeah.
about what they were looking to do at the time. I think we were mentioning before this was only 6 months or so after they had organized.
Yeah.
So maybe you could tell.
Yeah, well, Singleton had great ideas for building a big systems company.
Mm-hmm.
And with military systems, and you could see that integrated circuits were going to play a key role in that. And he discussed this with Art Rock, and Art knew that I would consider the idea of leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Although before I even hinted to Art that I was going to leave in this July thing, he said, "Why don't you talk to Singleton?" He was trying to
mm-hmm.
promote something there, I think. So Singleton, I just, and George Kosmetsky, John, and as I say, went down there together.
Right.
And I just hit it off. Here's a guy with just the opposite of Fairchild. He said, "I really need integrated circuits, and I need you to build them." And it's what I wanted to do, because I could see the... I was satisfied by then we could build them.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see that, as I had said earlier, a new technology needs a new environment to really flourish.
Mm-hmm.
And Fairchild was transistor and diode oriented. And understandably, I mean, the company was just beginning to reach its real growth phase.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing they needed was a complicated thing like this as a major activity.
Right.
So Singleton needed them, and I wanted to build them. And John and I very quickly, he was very frank with me, and I was extremely impressed with him, and still was the whole time I was there, because you can gather, I don't take well to somebody being my boss. And I willingly worked for Singleton for 12 years.
And now his background was also from MIT.
Yeah.
In electrical engineering.
Electrical engineering, yeah. He spent the war years working on demagnetization of ships.
Uh-huh.
And he went back and finished his doctorate after the war, and had Jerry Wiesner as his junior lab partner or something like that. And then Wiesner went on to run the place, run MIT.
Right.
But then Singleton went, I think, I don't know, GE or something like that, and they went to Litton and built up their inertial guidance system.
Mm-hmm.
And was a very determined guy. He said, our biggest customer was on Long Island, so every Sunday night I took a red eye there and saw what they were doing on Monday, and flew back Monday afternoon. He said, I did that for months and months.
Wow.
I mean, this is...
Mm-hmm.
And Kosmetsky, I could see, was a very sharp business guy.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, I hit it off with him. And I said, "You want to build another Litton?" He said, "Hell no, I want to build another GE. But we talked frankly, John and Kos and Henry and me, for 4 hours or something like that. And I just wasn't seeing that many negatives, except they said, "We want to put this in L.A. And I said, "This is a non-negotiable thing. This has to be in Silicon Valley."
Mm.
for a large number of reasons.
And what were they?
The logistical infrastructure that had been built up. You could get the right chemicals by then.
Mm-hmm.
And we were using chemicals that, when we started Fairchild, you'd buy... 100 cc bottle of it, and we were by then getting carloads. You had tank cars of these very corrosive acids, and you don't develop that, or how do you get rid of them?
Right.
We just poured them down the drain, a lot of them, and that whole Palo Alto's sewer system is just loaded with gold. It's probably rich gold ore. And so And I also knew that I'd be hiring other people.
Right.
You know, patent lawyers were there. The whole
thing was naturally. The infrastructure.
Led itself to putting it there. What? This business of scaling up is something that happened long before that, but I needed some special kind of an oil as a lubricant for polishing wafers to get them thin enough. And this was an oil that the big refineries dealt with all the time, but I couldn't, nobody was going to sell me a couple gallons of it, just all I needed. So I just called the oil company and said, what's your carload price for this oil? And send me a sample 100-gallon drum. which showed up, this big drum that was enough for all the years we did it. But trying to work with the existing structure to get the chemicals we needed. I don't like microscopes. We needed these stereo microscopes. And I called Bausch & Lomb and said, what is your price for 20 of these microscopes? He said, we make 4 of them a year. But they rose to the occasion and scaled up. But we were taking laboratory, essentially chemical processes that were done on micro scale and turning them into mass production. I mean, starting to work with a production line with hydrofluoric acid, which is a horrible corrosive acid, not the least of which you don't notice you've been attacked by it. It doesn't hurt when you put it on there, and then pretty soon you get a big ulcerous, uncurable wound. Mm-hmm. And how do you enforce discipline on people that make them wear a mask, and how you get a rubber glove that doesn't have little holes in it. So from the chemical engineering point of view, there was an awful lot of work that took place steadily
in
getting boron compounds and all these other diffusion compounds and getting extremely pure water.
Yeah.
I mean, and something that got a very bad name recently is trichloroethylene. And Gordon, we were concerned about this, and Gordon probably told you this, but he went to some chemical engineers at Stanford or Berkeley or something and said, what are the health problems of using lots of trichloroethylene? And the answer he got back was, the only thing we can see is you have a big enough tank of it and you fell in and you drowned. But that was the existing climate for that kind of a chemical use that nobody knew of these things. And now, as we were saying earlier, these things are overblown now. It's gone 180 degrees the other way. And I feel that the biggest cause of pollution is more and more sensitive instruments.
Yeah.
Because now you measure a part per billion, and nobody knows the difference between a part per million and a part per ten, and it looks like you could pick up anything and find a part of 100 billion of something horrible in it.
Right.
And so these ideas just took a long time to develop, and we undercompensate and then overcompensate. So that's it's been a steady development. And now with our legal system, that nothing is anybody's personal fault or responsibility, and society has to take care of it. These problems have gotten a lot worse. And there are lawsuits, class action lawsuits for trivia are a serious problem, I think. But we did the best we could, and I remember we were having trouble with this corrosive mixture, you know, eating out drain pipes and stuff. And there was once when some salesman said, I've got the ideal material. Cliff came in and put it in the drain. I poured the stuff in and never even slowed down. It just went right through this pipe. Just no time. So that was the sort of practical problems we were facing in scaling up here.
Sure.
Getting the chemicals, disposing of them properly, using them properly was the major problem.
And having worked with that scale up, I guess that really set the infrastructure in place that would make the location of the Imelco facility non-negotiable.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Building on that previous work. Mm-hmm.
So
Teledyne's real, it was integrated circuits for their systems, for computers.
Yeah.
And was Imelco formed as a subsidiary company or?
It was
a division.
It was a division, and the reason it was called Imelco was that Teledyne's first acquisition down here was called Imelco. It was a division that had tax losses.
Hmm.
And Kosmetsky said, if we give it that name, we can move their tax loss to your company and all that sort of sort of thing.
Finance.
So it was a name I've never been very excited about, but. It made sense at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, it was changed back to Teledyne.
Right.
Years later. But, so, Singleton was very, forceful, and I could see that he wanted to do what I wanted to do.
Mm.
Something we didn't clear up all that well. I mean, this Teledyne was pretty much under finance, and I said, this is going to be a pretty expensive operation. I'm going to build optical equipment like the world has never seen before.
Mm.
And I did. I built the step and repeat setup. The first step in it was a bed camera 20 feet long. And I had to put these things on granite blocks to keep vibration down. So.
Mm.
But, so it was an expensive undertaking, and Singleton says we're up to it as a company. But we never cleared up is if the systems people needed something,
mm-hmm.
that was the first priority, was to make it for them. If they didn't need it, our priority was to support ourselves with outside products.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't turn this on and off.
Mm.
And that was a fundamental weakness with the Imelco organization, was the need to satisfy these two masters.
Mm. Because you couldn't predict when the demands from the system...
Well, you can't have them come in and disrupt the production line where you promised product to somebody.
Right.
And when they couldn't get it, they go complain to Singleton. And it was a never-ending problem.
Mm.
But Jean and I... were very taken with Singleton, and as was our custom, we went out to the Mojave. This was New Year's Eve. We still had our business suits on, as we call them. Each of us had one suit, so it was our negotiating suit. We used the phrase many times, put on your negotiating suit. And there was a bar in San Francisco then that had it said every night is New Year's Eve, and they passed out noisemakers. And so Jean and I were standing there in the midnight in the center of the Mojave blowing noisemakers with our business suits on. But I had a number of other questions asked Singleton, but we quickly resolved those. And the thing that I had one set of questions that still remain, about Fairchild's role in integrated circuits,
mm-hmm.
and I was had talked to Noyce briefly about that, and he said, "Well, a systems company is not the place to do this sort of thing." And he was pretty negative about what a systems company. He was right in some aspects of this, but finally I got down to her. I had one set of questions I wanted to ask Singleton, and I wanted to ask Noyce the same questions. And I called Noyce, and he was busy with an Italian negotiation. And his secretary said, "We can see you in 2 days." And I called Singleton. He said, "Well, it's 10 o'clock. I can be up there by about 11:30.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, "Well, that answers the question."
Mm. Yeah, on where they felt the priorities lay for integrated circuits. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And here, that gave the opportunity to Melco to do some marvelous technical advance. We made some really spectacular products there. In small quantities that disappeared into the classified world, so
there's
not much known about it now. And I don't know who some of the stuff, all this stuff. But
we've talked about Izzy Haas several times, but I don't think we've talked about his background yet. Could you tell me a little bit more about him? Because he was one of the first people in the Melco division.
Yeah, he was born in Turkey. His father was some kind of a Jewish merchant in Turkey or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he got educated at Roberts University or something. So he was educated in English.
Mm-hmm.
He came to this country and got his, I think, master's degree in electrical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And turned into this marvelous breed between a circuit designer and fabricator and an electrical engineer that understood the end use of the product.
Mm.
So he was extremely valuable, and I worked with him all during this period.
In some ways it strikes me that that the business strategy for the Melco division was, in a way, almost the opposite, in a number of respects, from the Fairchild business strategy.
It
was integrated circuits, not over transistors, and it was sort of more limited, special purpose customers or projects rather than these mass market.
And the idea of military support for our development activities.
Oh, you did do that as well.
At a Melco. I mean, that was our customer. And I know at Fairchild, I had a delegation from a pretty high-level bunch of guys from the military and said, "Why don't you ever bid on our contracts?" And I said, "That just... we want to be able to control our destiny." And then I was fairly abrupt and said, "There's just no way we're going to do this." Because I started thinking, the company that scared the death out of me was the company called Pacific Semiconductors.
Mm-hmm.
They had a lot of, I don't know what sort of happened there, but they had some damn good technology. And I thought that they, when we were starting out, would give us the ones that most likely would give us a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And I started looking that they were taking government contracts for some really sophisticated transistor. There was going to be one of them in the system. It'd be a driving transistor and run everything else. And so that took military development.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we were looking at the hundreds and thousands of transistors that were going to be the integral part of the circuit.
Right.
And I said, we just can't use our scarce resources building these one-of-a-kind things.
Mm-hmm.
At the way Fairchild was set up.
Right.
And so we just never bid. But when we got into the Teledyne thing, one, we didn't have that much money, and two, we could start developing some of the stuff with government.
Mm-hmm.
And I started seeing the terrible inefficiency of government contracts.
In what way?
It's a lot of work to write a contract like this.
Mm-hmm.
And say if a small contract is going to be a $50,000 contract, you have a dozen companies each spending $10,000 to submit the proposal. It's just a terrible waste of resources. So I bid on a few contracts and got them. Long Alton Gilliam, that I had been my predecessor at MIT, came to work for us, and he and I worked on optically coupling devices. Four decades before its time. But we did. We could take devices and emitted light and hitch them to other devices. I wrote a paper about that once. So
did that also make sense because for the systems division, their main customer was also...
Yeah, it was the same
group,
same customer.
The military.
Yeah. And so I got to know my way around the Pentagon and the Dayton Air Force Base,
right,
and Fort Monmouth and all those great places. But there were some good people in those places. Jim, later went to be a professor at Stanford, came out of that environment. I'm drawing a blank on his name.
Mm-hmm.
If I said it, you'd know it. But go on.
Oh well. I guess what I wanted to know were you co-managing the division?
We started out that way. John and I were co-managing it, and which was not a comfortable role for either of us.
Mm-hmm.
John's approach was to get down on the floor and invent new stuff or work on field effect transistors or something like that. And I said, we have to have somebody that's overlooking, taking a broader financial view of things. And whereas Fairchild was, Singleton was supporting us as well as he could. The money was very slim and was slow to come through. So I was working on that aspect of it. As we started developing products, John had a better rapport with his marketing people, and he finally said, because of a lot of the marketing considerations, I want to work and I want to be the manager. I said, that's fine with me, and my interest is in this other stuff anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
And in starting in Melco, I was very lucky in getting a guy named Bob Lewis, who is an optical engineer, excellent optical engineer. He just came in and said, hey, you folks need an optical engineer. And with his active development work, we built just a spectacular optical setup. There's nothing like it in the world.
For making integrated
circuits. Yeah, so we can make integrated circuits that were beyond other people's capabilities, make very elaborate circuits. And we were probably limited by diffusion technology, and we were very slow on epitaxy.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get into that. It was just too big an investment. So that ultimately slowed us down a lot when the integrated circuit world turned into an epitaxial.
Right.
Way, which solved all of my initial problems with isolation, because then you didn't have to worry about this. And eventually led to the MOS approach to things.
What was Sheldon Roberts doing in the early period?
He was spending a lot of his time working on high quality solar cells, which was a great interest of his when he was leaving Fairchild. And that's something the world was really needed, was a higher efficiency solar cell. And he had sort of mixed efforts there, and he was helping with, you know, various materials problems as they arose.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, this was not a satisfying relation for him, so he left. Kleiner left just about the same time and came to work with us on a consulting basis.
Mm-hmm.
And helped us get the business side of the thing put together.
Hmm. I hadn't realized that.
Yeah, so he'd come in, you know, every so often and help set up all these various procedures, you know.
Right.
For all the things that I had not had to deal with at Fairchild, but I'm certainly going to have to deal with him at Imelco, and he helped educate me on that. He was very helpful. This was before, you know, he was just getting ready to start in the venture capital role at that time. He was very helpful to us.
Well, with this very advanced optical system that you and
Bob Lewis
developed, was the